Hey guys, Maria Menounos here. Before your favorite TV after show begins, we want to let you know about my new show on SiriusXM Stars Channel 109. It's called Conversations with Maria, and it's live Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Go to conversationswithmaria.com for more info. Buzz you later.
You're tuning in to the online broadcast network, AfterBuzz TV. Over 20 million weekly downloads in over 150 countries and your number one source for after show entertainment. AfterBuzz TV, the destination for TV superfans, producing aftershows for over 300 of your favorite TV shows, interviewing celebrities and showrunners, and bringing you behind-the-scenes exclusives. All thanks to E! Entertainment's Maria Menounos, producer Kevin Undergaro, and internet leader Akamai. Now, let the buzz begin!
Oh, starting it off real mellow on this one. Hello, AfterBuzzers. Welcome to the People vs. O.J. Simpson American Crime Story After Show here on AfterBuzz TV. My name's Pegarad. I am joined by the lovely...
Are you talking about
me?
Yeah,
you.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm kidding. Hey, everyone. I'm Stephanie Georgie. You can follow me on Twitter at Stephanie Georgie.
I'm Shaka Smith. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Shaka Strong.
And you're very lovely as well. And I'm Chris Howard. You follow me on Twitter at Chris Howard Live and LegendaryLivingDaily.com.
You guys, don't forget to subscribe to our channel, leave comments, find us on iTunes, find us on SoundCloud, give us 5 stars, comment. We want to hear from you guys. So keep it coming. We have some shout outs.
We do have some shout outs. We appreciate all of you who are commenting right now. Shout out to Lynn Reed, Kelly Hope, Mary Kay Pearl, Champese, Mr. Henry 84, Dave 155, T Hopkins, and Beth Jones. Much love.
Really appreciate you.
Yeah.
So today we're going to talk about season 1, episode 3, called The Dream Team, and how this episode went from, guys, this case is a slam dunk, to mother...
We thought you were going to say it.
But before we get into that, Stephanie has a quick word from our sponsors.
I do, from our Blue Apron sponsors. Not only do you feel like you know your way around a kitchen, but cooking at home means eating healthier and saving money instead of ordering expensive takeout again. But where do you start? Blue Apron has you covered. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers all fresh ingredients you need to create home-cooked meals. Just follow the easy step-by-step instructions. Each meal can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. No overwhelming trips to the grocery store, no more set takeout. No matter your dietary preferences, Blue Apron makes it a breeze to discover and prepare dishes like a roast chicken supreme with mashed potatoes, gravy, and maple glazed carrots. They have a steak sandwich with caramelized onions, garlic aioli, and a honey-roasted parsnip. And then for the veggie lovers, there's a charred broccolini over creamy polenta with poached eggs right in your very own kitchen. Cook with ingredients that you've never used before, like watermelon radishes, farro, and purple potatoes. And recipes are between 500 to 700 calories per portion. Delicious and good for you. Right now, you can get your first 2 meals for free at blueapron.com/podcast. That's blueapron.com/podcast. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
I'm going to go eat now. Yeah. Bye, guys. So we start the episode out with Robert Kardashian taking the kids to Chin Chin in the valley.
You mean Richard Cardovian?
Oh, yeah. And he's checking in and he gets recognized. Yeah. And they sit down and the kids are kind of blown away. Like, Daddy just got recognized. We didn't have to wait in line. Oh, my gosh.
Recognized. I was like, that was the beginning of the Kardashian
Isn't that
fame.
Crazy?
Yes, that was the first. And Cardovian, as you said.
Yeah.
Right. And he's trying to bring them down to earth right away. He's like, fame is fleeting. It's hollow. Just, it's not important. What'd you guys think?
I thought it was great. It was nice to see all of that. I really actually liked the girl who played Courtney. I think she did kind of a really great job. It was funny to me. And I don't know. It was nice to see Robert Kardashian be the way that he was and the way that Michael described him last week.
Yeah. And I think they were trying to underscore this man of values and how he stuck with OJ. Because later on in the episode, you start to see a little bit of doubt creep in his mind. And
of course.
Yeah. I think they were trying to really juxtapose and show you that he was this really principled man, but, you know, even for him, the evidence started to get overwhelming.
Overwhelming for sure, because he's got, you know, he's got so much that's going on. He's got his friend that's there. He's got, you know, he was torn for sure. And I love the fact that his values were screamed out in contrast to what a lot of people think of the Kardashians of today when they mm-hmm. think of fame. Mm-hmm. And he was there. No, being a good friend and having a good heart, puts everything else to shame. So it's just very interesting.
Yeah, and I think in context, we see the whole thing with Chloe and Lamar and how mm-hmm. she's really stood by this guy who's her ex-husband and they're just friends, but she has stood by him so steadfastly. Mm-hmm. And you start to look at this and you go, maybe they got those values. Maybe they were instilled in the right places.
I'm sure they did. And with the absence of Robert, though, of course, things can get a little blurry. Yeah. And with the, the effect of the fame that you get, they're famous for being famous.
Yeah.
So that obviously is going to change some people. It's a nice reminder. Hopefully the girls watch the show and remember that themselves.
Yeah. And the one thing I'll add to that is just that, Chris was really showing up in this episode as well as having, she was standing up to Robert at that point. So, to put all of the values just in Robert, it's like Chris was standing up and saying, hey, this is wrong. Mm-hmm. So she was standing up for her beliefs as well, which was kind of neat.
Absolutely.
What did you think about it?
I love just seeing who he really was, because I didn't know much about him. You hear about him, you see his photos from back then, but just knowing that he was such a warm, worldly
father
human. Yeah. He was a good human being, and that was just refreshing to kind of see. Let's talk about Marcia Clark. So she has a press conference. She announces the charges against OJ. And she thinks that this is a slam dunk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And slowly we're seeing, Gil Garcetti comes in and they're talking about Shaka. We want to talk about the evidence and how that stuff's coming out. But they're going to have the trial in downtown as opposed to Santa Monica. What's the importance of that?
Yeah, well, with race and the change of venue. So, he was worried about the optics of going downtown, of going to Santa Monica and having an all-white jury. Mm-hmm. Doesn't look great. Versus downtown, you might have a more diverse jury. But I think they were looking at it before race was injected on the other side into the whole, the whole conversation. So they're thinking, we don't want to inflame the community by having an all-white jury convict this black guy who's an icon of the black community. Had they ever known the other side was going to really inject race into the whole conversation, I think they would have made a different decision. But watching it, you start to see that kind of, you start to see the first cracks, because you know it's coming, So you start to see the first cracks of, okay, that was a bad decision. That was a poor decision. That was a poor decision. So.
That and every decision compounded on the fact that we also had Rodney King just before.
Yeah.
So the city was already incited, and I remember when Rodney King, that whole thing went down. It was serious. It was the real deal. I mean, I've never seen anything like that in Los Angeles.
And I think you see that a little bit with Darden kind of informing Marcia. Look, a lot of black people don't think he did it. So I think you see very early on them not realizing the actual racial tension that was happening around this case. And I think they made decisions not really plugged into that thought or idea. And then Darden slowly starts to inform Marcia throughout this episode, hey, this is broader than just this case.
Do you think that if the trial was held in Santa Monica, it would have been a different outcome?
I think it's possible, because they really did make race the crux of, a lot of what was happening. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to have different juries perceive it in different ways. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We get into Jill Shively, right? She's on TV. She's getting her 15 minutes of fame. She's doing these interviews for $5,000. But why was Marcia so disturbed by that?
Because it takes the genuineness from her witness, Like, okay, are you choosing to be a witness so that you can get this $5,000 and be on TV? Or are you a witness and you're trying to make sure that this man is convicted for what you think he did? So she just needs, and being a female, all of your evidence has to be concrete so that you are taken seriously, especially during that time when I said, it probably was sexist. She can't show emotion. Why? Because what would you do if you saw a woman cry in the courtroom? Would you take her seriously? Probably not. So I think that that's why she's trying to implement to everybody and trying to tell everyone that we need this to be serious and they need to not talk to anyone. And when they're talking, it better be in the courtroom and that's it.
That's a huge thing. She was the only eyewitness in this whole case.
And she was paid for the interview that she gave. And I think that was really troublesome, because the other side's going to say this witness is only out for a payday.
Yeah.
Of course, I'd be a witness if I have the time and opportunity if I'm going to get paid, And so I think she was avoiding that spectacle. But I think it was probably a mistake to not have the only eyewitness testify.
Right. Does the prosecution have any sort of hold against these witnesses? I don't know anything about that, but can they say don't do any interviews?
She did. I think Marsha said that she lied to her. I think she had told her not to say anything. I mean, I'm not going
to
lie.
They can advise you, but they can't hold you to any. Yeah.
And the problem is that once it's out there, it's out there. And, you know, we see that today in cases all the time where they're trying to educate the juries before the juries get in. And OJ, I think, was the first time that that really happened. But Marsha seemed to be the only person that was really, to her credit, that was really concerned about that.
Yeah.
You know, everybody else behind the scenes says, don't worry about it, Marsha. It's okay. It's going to get out there.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that we might see. I don't know if it was the sexism thing that made her really have that viewpoint. But usually as an attorney, you want that to be in the media. Press. You want really the jury, the potential members of the jury, to already come in going, he's guilty. Mm-hmm. I've already heard the witness on A Current Affair.
Right.
I've already heard this narrative already, and I already believe he's guilty.
If I was Marsha, I would think, great, because now the prosecution's going to come, and my first question to that woman would be, so would you say that you might be someone who would say something just for the money?
No, and I agree, but you know? I kind of like the idea of the jury already coming in and having made their minds up.
Right, you know? I mean, because it was said, but...
Yeah.
Yeah,
which was because what blows me away is how every one of these decisions becomes such a critical driver of where everything is going to go.
Yeah, especially because you know hindsight's 2020, so we know the outcome. So now we can just see and you know pick over it with a fine tooth comb.
Exactly. Robert Shapiro losing his marbles in his office. He has the magazines all spread out. He's going crazy. We start to see the dream team being built.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He decides to call F. Lee Bailey. Tell us about the case. Was it Christina?
Yeah, that was... So F. Lee Bailey that was originally... And I thought this was so we looked it up afterwards. But he was... Sam Shepard was the first person... He wasn't the first person F. Lee Bailey tried, but Sam Shepard was the movie The Fugitive, where with Harrison Ford and the one-armed man about a doctor whose wife was killed. Very prestigious, good-looking doctor. Wife is killed. And he flees... and he was an innocent man, and it was interesting that when Bob Shapiro called F. Lee Bailey in, F. Lee Bailey talks about that case. He says, "You know, I defended him, and I got the conviction overturned, but he fled because he was innocent."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that was really important. That let's show that this run was a run by an innocent man, and who better to do it than someone who's already kind of been
done
through showing this already? Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah. Getting crazy. Alan
Dershowitz.
Big time lawyer. Number one lawyer, they called him?
Yeah.
The number one lawyer in America.
Yeah. According to Bob Shapiro, that's what Bob thought.
That's crazy. If Bob's saying that, it must be true, huh?
Yeah, and I thought that was great to hire him. And, you know, he came with his investigator and his DNA expert. And so I think you saw the money start to come into play even more so here, because he can just hire every great attorney.
I can't imagine how much that would...
A fortune.
Yeah. And millions. You had to feel the prosecution must have started to feel buried by this dream team. Like, they're just adding just stellar lawyer after lawyer. But I think Dershowitz really comes in and makes a difference with that DNA expert.
I love how he's throwing out Harvard every chance he gets. I'm going to go back to Boston. Harvard.
You know what? Get out of here, guy.
And the DNA expert, Barry Scheck, he did play a massive role in this trial in the end. I mean, and the whole strategy was laid out there, that they were going to disqualify every piece of DNA that came in. And what interested me also was they were talking about DNA as if it was something brand new. We hear about it every day now.
Yeah, right.
So this was just the beginnings.
Yeah, we live in this DNA culture, and it's funny because now attorneys, we're almost behind the eight ball, because juries don't believe you unless you don't have, unless you do have DNA. And so it's funny to see it now. It's in its infancy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, nowadays, so quickly, 20 years now, that juries expect you to have DNA evidence, you know?
Yeah, so his whole thing is he wants to throw it out. If it was mishandled, the way it was collected, the way it was analyzed. So their whole goal is to just get it completely thrown out or cause doubt in the jurors' minds, question it.
Yeah, and that's one thing with the rules of evidence when it comes to court is there's a lot of stuff you can keep out. I think, the general public always wonders, how come this person wasn't convicted because here's all this evidence in front of you? A lot of the stuff you see in the media may not have come in at trial because of evidentiary rules. So the jury's not allowed to consider certain things.
That blows my mind. Yeah. That something could be so clear and evident, but you can't use it in the court.
And what was wild was when Bob Kardashian said, okay, so this DNA evidence, tell me about it. you know, what's the chances that we could prove that it's not his blood? And he said, well, it's like one in a billion.
I know.
And he said, we're screwed.
Yeah. Right.
And then he says, we can keep it out.
Yeah.
So, that's funny in contrast with later on Bob Shapiro saying, you know, I guess it was a trailer for the next one, but says, who believes OJ is innocent? Or who believes OJ did it? Nobody raises their hand. They're like, good.
Me neither.
I believe he's innocent too.
Yeah. Real quick though, just wanted to mention that if any of you are watching right now live, please feel free to tweet if you want to join in on this discussion and have any questions or anything like that. Go ahead.
You're reading our Twitter feed. Awesome. What's our hashtag?
We have hashtag ABTVACS.
Awesome. Pat McKenna. So he's the investigator. He brings up a huge point.
Mm-hmm.
Furman. Mark Furman. We start to get the backstory about him. Apparently, back in the day, he had racial.
Yeah, well, he sued the city because he said the job made him a bigot.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that's pretty huge.
And how does the job make somebody a bigot? I don't get that part.
Well, what I don't appreciate about that is that that's just stupid. That's when he's saying that his experience, because of an experience, it made him that way. When you shouldn't.
Well, you know, I don't completely discount what he said, because I still believe that, you know, the LAPD, or not the LAPD, but in a lot of police departments, you have a systemic history of a culture that views different minorities differently.
Okay.
And so I think it's very possible you can come into an organization.
Oh, right, because he's suing LAPD, not...
Well, he's suing the city. But,
the city, that's what to say. Okay,
yeah,
forgive
me. As a result of his job in the LAPD. And so it doesn't surprise me that it's possible that a culture can make you start to treat other minorities differently.
Sure, but if you're used to it.
And of course, because he's suing the city, it's very strongly worded as to how he was, you know, how he was made into a bigot.
Right.
So, but do you think, like, is that a socioeconomic thing, or is it really a race thing? Because if the crime that they're going to fight is in lower socioeconomic areas of the city, you're going to find minorities.
Yeah. And then, well, you know, I think whether or not in that particular area they would treat a white person differently than they would treat a black person, who knows. But even so, whether it's race or socioeconomics, he's primed to view things a certain different way, and that's what he's alleging. But and that's a different conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But what's important about this is that he's an admitted racist, you know, before this trial even begins.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what.
So this is a bombshell.
This is huge.
Game changer.
Absolute game changer.
They're already saying, you know, that the glove that was found in Rockingham, the blood on the Bronco. So they're gathering up these little tidbits that they're going to.
So he's got the best parts of the evidence against OJ is by this guy who said before that it's begun, I'm a racist, you know? So that's crazy.
Huge.
He had done a manuscript for a book with an author, and he wrote all sorts of stuff using, you know, racial epithets and using language that today just wouldn't be supported by any other people other than in the black community. Yeah. Then it's all cool. It's all good. But that's good.
So Shapiro takes this news, this bunch, like these bullets.
Yeah.
And he gets Jeff Toobin to sit down with him, and he tells him. And at that time, Jeff Toobin was working for The New Yorker, explains to him that this is a thing. This is a thing about race, that we're going to play this. And he writes this insane article.
F. Lee Bailey says, I hear the clanking of balls.
No, my God. That was such an awesome line.
That was.
Oh, yeah. Whoever wrote that, that was brilliant.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Because he said you laid out the complete game strategy for this.
Yeah.
And you know, to Bob Shapiro's credit, you know, he's doing his job, and he was doing his job very well to bring in other people, to bring in the right people at the right times. He was defending his client, which is,
and,
you know,
essentially what he's doing.
And we had that Time magazine cover that just added to,
so
whether or not it was racist intentionally or not, we now have that part of the kind of, you know, the society, everyone's thinking, hey, maybe there is a racist culture that's happening, because it was a darker image on the Time magazine cover than that was of the picture that was actually taken.
Right.
But we saw that when they were editing it, they thought it looked more dramatic. But versus when it comes out, people are saying, hey, look what they're doing, you know?
Look blacker. And I read the titles on those magazines, because there was both Time and there was Newsweek, and Newsweek had, Trail of Blood was the headline on Newsweek, and American Tragedy was on Time, so you just see this whole thing rolling out with, and then the racial divides beginning to open up.
I mean, I think for me, right away at that, like, if I had seen something like that, that's where my head would go. And then I would begin to think, whoa, this is, like, this is a race issue. Why are you trying to make it, like, you know, I would just be very offended by that and then, and really question what's going on.
Yeah, exactly.
They did such a great job of making it look like the actual cover. His expression that just, wow. Let's get into Johnny Cochran. We have Dale Cochran, his wife, who we may have on the show next week. Yay. Spoiler alert.
That's a big spoiler.
So she is kind of urging him to get on this case. And I thought that was so badass. I loved it, you know? Like,
It reminded me of House of Cards, the wife.
Totally a Claire moment.
You know, that's a wife. That's a woman right there for you, supporting her man. And I think more so, I like that she knows how he thinks and who he is, and like as a representation to like what, you know, what he does and how he really would want to be a part of that.
It's like the kingmaker behind the king, you know, the wife. Right. Is, yeah, that was fascinating. And she's saying, would you... How would you feel if someone else were to get him off? Yeah.
Exactly. So then we cut to Shapiro and Robert in the jail talking to OJ, saying, we need to hire Cochran. We just have to. This would be so great for our case. And he's so against it. Why is he so against it?
Because of this is where his complex falls into play again. This is where he decides to say, is this a black thing? Because I'm not black. I'm OJ.
That line.
It's just funny to me that they make it a race thing, and I feel like OJ gets upset because in the back of his head, at the same time, he's like, "Well, I don't want it to look like that because I don't want people to look bad at my buddies." I feel like he was defending the LAPD and he was defending all this, and he didn't want to be a part of that.
And I think he remember from his background that you know he grew up poor and he grew up being defined as this black person who wasn't going to make it. And so I think he was like at this point where he felt like he had really transcended all of that. And then to then be viewed in that way again, it's almost like for him, he's still that black guy, that black kid trying to make it out of, you know, massive bad circumstances.
Yeah, but it's a massive identity crisis.
Yeah,
it is.
You know, and when that went down, he was like so far against it. What does that say about the strategy that they used? If they said, because he was saying, are you going to say that a racist cop took me down because I was a black person, but that was the strategy that eventually would get him out? What's that say about his guilt and innocence?
I think that just says he was very concerned about that being the issue, that he had worked his entire life to transcend this one thing, and now he's going to then be defined by it.
Right. Like, he'd rather the case be people fighting for OJ, not people fighting for this man of this race.
Yeah, now he's back. Yeah. It's almost he's back to point A where he was.
Go to Faye Resnick. Yeah. Look for the drugs. Yeah. Look for the.
But he just didn't want to think that it was now because.
He just didn't want this. Exactly.
You know, he thought, you know, we've done this already.
It wasn't the kind of press he wanted.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
But this was when Rob expresses at least what I saw as some real doubt with OJ, because he has a little fight with Chris, we see, where she's talking to him. And then he says, hey, we got to get Cochran because if you're not supposed to be here, let's get you out. And it was like, what do you mean if you're not supposed to be here, you shouldn't be here?
Right.
And it was this little small slip where it goes, if you're not supposed to be here, you shouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. And what's the if, you know?
Of course. I mean, it's really tough because when he's talking to Chris, the way that she gets angry is because she's trying to say, like, Rob, like, you know him, though.
Yeah, you know he did this, too.
Like, you remember, I think I said this in the first step, our first show, that when you know someone has the potential for it.
Yeah.
But you're loyal and you just can't say it. And it's unfair. And it just sucks.
And I don't think you ever believe amongst any close friend that they have a potential for murder. Even if someone's beating their wife, you're thinking, well, they would never do this.
And the godfather to your eldest daughter?
Yeah.
I mean,
he was in denial.
Yeah.
He was in denial. Yeah. I think he really was doing everything he possibly could to convince himself that he didn't do it.
Yeah. I watched one of his interviews via YouTube, and he did, though. The real Robert Kardashian didn't seem to have doubt. However, he did base it on, I know him, and you could just tell it was just like the loyalty and just kind of being that good friend.
And he was happy about the Mark Furmans. You know, like you could see that he was grasping, like, okay.
Good, this might be it.
Yeah.
Speaking of Mark Furman, Chris Darden gets that phone call about Mark Furman, and he runs to Marsha Clark and tells her about it. She turns around and wants him to take the case against AC Cowlings for aiding and abetting.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is kind of where we see them two really starting to form their little team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think, though, when she says, take this, I trust you, you can do it, and he's like, I can. She was really having to put the fire underneath him even then.
Yeah, I want to know where his doubt stemmed from. I mean, how did he not think that he was good enough? I guess we need to learn more about his background and his story, but
I don't think that he didn't think he was that good enough. I think his falls under his experience as well and the reality of things, meaning if this man is thinking, man, you know what, I kind of do think that OJ did it, but look at my own like community is going against it, and he knows how powerful that is.
And I wonder if he was having doubts of whether or not OJ did it.
Right.
Because the way he was saying things to Marsha, he was kind of cluing her in, like, this is not a foregone conclusion by everyone,
right,
possibly including myself.
Yes.
Because you can only imagine when he's hearing about Furman, and these things are starting to affect him as well, and he's in the black community, and he's hearing things about, you know, OJ's probably innocent. They're sending him up. So he may have had his own doubts about whether or not he was actually guilty.
Sure.
Do you guys think that Marsha called him in to balance the race card?
I did wonder that. I just wasn't
going to say it.
You did wonder it?
Yeah. I wondered it, but I didn't see enough evidence in the episode to know if that's why.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He keeps telling her it's an emotional thing, not rational.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was interesting.
And probably very true.
Yeah.
He said that, you said?
Well, yeah.
No, I was just.
Yeah, he was trying to impart to her, look, like, I understand that you think you have a mountain of evidence right now, but emotionally, people out there think he did not do this.
Right.
And you need to confront that fact.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that Nicole Brown 911 call real quick.
Yeah.
No, I don't want to be on the phone. He's about to beat the shit out of me. That was, I mean, I don't know if that was the actual recording, but the way she said it was, like, this has happened before. Like, you need to listen to me, and I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So that part's frustrating, and, man, I don't know what to tell you. Like, that happens, I feel like. Some, you know, couples, when they get in fights, it gets really bad.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that he didn't love her. Like, he said, that woman is the center of my world, and you know what? When you are in love like that, you know, people, like, the crime of passion, you know, that's the only person that can kind of trigger that in your head.
Yeah.
So it's when you hear that, it's just upsetting because you're like, oh my God, what she had to go through. And then if that actually did happen, then that's just horrible.
And it's never good to hear something that what you would normally think is damning, you know, if you're on the defense side.
Mm.
But what you didn't hear was you didn't actually hear him beat her.
Right.
You heard that she was not in fear of like an imminent beating because don't bring the paramedics, you know, like.
I'm fine.
Yeah. So there was a sense of she was calling the cops. She wasn't exactly like. She was in some sort of fear, but not enough where she thought,
Someone get over here now.
Yeah. It didn't feel like her life was in the balance for this.
Mm-hmm. See, I thought she did say, he's going to beat the shit out of me.
Yeah, she said that, but then they ask her, like, do you think does he have weapons, or is he going to hurt you? Huh. And has he hurt you already?
Yeah.
I'm fine. Don't bring the ambulance. And so I think you didn't have a beating on there. You had her afraid, but you also had something that was very routine about it.
Exactly. And it was more like, I need you guys just to get this man out of my property right
now. And so almost getting ahead of it and hearing that in the media and getting the chance now as a defense to spin the narrative for weeks, months before the trial happens, kind of gets rid of the shocking awe of that tape.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a great tape to come out, but you have some time now to kind of spin it your way in the public at least.
And you could hear OJ yelling in the background. Did you hear that?
Oh yeah, he sounded very angry in that.
I know, but we all yell. I can sound that angry too.
Yeah.
Does anybody know if that was real or if there was an actual?
I think it very well could have been the actual tape. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't see why they wouldn't use the real tape
or it might be just like too shocking or jarring. Or, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I heard it in real time when it happened. I remember it now, and you know, it sounds exactly the same. And I don't know why they wouldn't. I think it's public domain as far as
they've been using the real footage from the news. It's interesting. Yeah. Probably look that up. So the New Yorker article comes out. All this stuff comes out about Furman, and Bailey calls it masterful. They're back in the race.
Yeah.
Wild. I mean, they are, because at the end of the day, it could be, you know, it really could be the other way around. It's just, and that was awesome to hear it. And then they just, I don't know. It's just so sensitive and so hurtful. Cause now I'm still thinking about Nicole's voice, like, oh no. Mm. But
What's wildest is how they spin the narrative and how you just literally write the story that it's going to be. And then they each have their story and the truth lies somewhere in between.
To me, it was powerful. If the person finding the most damning evidence against a black suspect is someone who says, I am a bigot because of this job.
Right.
What else do you want? It's like, drop the mic. You're good to go.
Exactly.
And so, I think that was that Effley Bailey drop the mic moment of like, wow.
Yeah, he raised his own hand for that. Yeah, he said, yes, I am a bigot. Yeah. And by the way, it's your fault.
Yeah, that's crazy to me.
And that says exactly what Marsha Clark says. She's like, this article is a declaration of war. Yeah. Like, this is it. Mm-hmm. Crazy.
Yeah.
So then we get into the final bits of the episode where they're trying to bring Cochran in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And finally, Cochran comes in, and he needs to look him in the eyes.
Absolutely.
What did you think about when OJ was saying, I didn't do it? I don't know. For me, it just felt like he was trying to convince himself. That's the way that I was looking at
it. Okay, two things. One, I love that Cochran said that because I'm the same way. Like, I work at a restaurant also, and I always say I have to like the food that I sell. Otherwise, like, you know, you're not convincing. People know the truth. Yeah. And then for me, with Cuba, this is the first, or excuse me, with OJ, if he didn't cry as much with everyone else, but it just goes to show you again, like, he had to go that much harder because I feel like he couldn't play this person. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's if he were not to be innocent. Like, I just felt like it was different. I felt like he acted more emotional with this guy than with Shapiro, than with Kardashian, than with anybody else that he has spoken to up until this point. Mm-hmm. So I felt like he was even more scared at this moment and really needed Cochran to come through.
Yeah, you first.
Well, I love that Cochran has to see him. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think what, at least what the series was highlighting was the integrity of some of the lawyers.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I even thought with Robert Shapiro earlier on, how his reputation was so important. I really did think that was for the client.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have Cochran who's like, I need to believe this guy if I'm really going to defend him. Mm-hmm. And I think that really translates because if your lawyers have the integrity to believe you, to want to honestly believe you, and they do, they're going to show that in the courtroom. That's going to come through. The way he, you know, he really focused on the "I love OJ" when he really focused on the "I loved her." No way I could have done. No way I could have done this. But the way he was saying it was almost like there was a cognitive dissonance between himself in that cell talking to Johnny and the guy that killed Nicole and Ron.
Mm-hmm.
So it almost sounded like he did it, but he just could not believe that was him. That was another person. I'm this person. I love Nicole so much. I would never do that. But that was another person.
I think you're spot on that.
Yes.
I've done a lot of work in lie detection, actually, and physiology. And I grew a company of the biggest company in the world of neuro-linguistic programming, which is watching the IQs and the things like that and listening to the language. And the first thing that they do, you just described perfectly and accurately, like with CIA lie detection techniques and stuff, they'll look for, because the liar,
the
what
extra
they'll do
words.
Is the extra words, but the things that they can cling to from a certainty perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I loved her. She was the mother of my children.
The center of my world.
The center of my world. You've got to believe me, Johnny. None of that stuff says, I didn't do this.
Because he said the first thing I want you to know.
I didn't do it.
No, he said I didn't do it, but he said the first thing I want you to know, I love Nicole. Which is the first thing when he said, did you do it?
Yeah.
So it was like the first thing should be, no, I love Nicole.
Exactly.
Right.
And so, but what I kind of like now that I'm seeing, you know, in this episode, it seems that Ryan Murphy, in the areas where he probably didn't know exactly what happened, you know, he doesn't know the exact tenor of what's happening, he gives you enough to go either way.
Right.
You know what I mean? Hey, OJ looks like maybe he did it, but Johnny Cochran's looking in his eyes and goes, I believe you.
Mm-hmm.
So you get enough to kind of go either way. So I do like, I think I'm seeing somewhat of a balanced perspective on
what's
happening.
Which I love, because we could take what we want from it and just run with it.
And that's how it really was in real time, too, because as each piece came out, it had society was going, what, what, what? Mm-hmm. Well, of course he did. Wait a second, this Mark Furman guy. So this is really accurate. What we're experiencing here is what we experienced then.
Absolutely.
Crazy. I think that's our episode. Do you guys have anything else you wanted to touch on?
No, I mean, just... little more on exactly what we were just talking about, how it's funny how I think that it's possible once you continue to say things, you do begin to believe that.
Yeah.
And then it's like just when the mind goes somewhere else. So there comes a point where maybe he did forget his actions, or if he did black out or whatever it is, that's why he's just sticking to it. But there are some, I feel like there's sometimes when he's looking, like when he was on the bar and he put his head against and he was watching it, I feel like those are the moments like, I feel like I could see even that, which makes that incredible acting from Cuba, but like where it's like he's reflecting on it.
Yeah.
And just to add that to that point and accentuate it, he was saying, I just need you to believe, Johnny, I didn't do this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what he said. Yeah. I just need you to believe I didn't do this. Right. I love that woman. So everything he said, technically, even if he did it, was true.
Yeah. And I kind of want to know this, based on not your thoughts on OJ, whether he did or not, which you can also offer, that'd be great, but based on what you've seen so far in the series, so if you had fresh eyes, what would you think of OJ's innocence or guilt, based on the episodes that we've seen here in this series?
That's a great question.
I personally think I would fall into race again, too.
Yeah.
I think I would be caught in the two because I would have to pride myself in saying, I don't know those people.
Yeah.
And then we do have the evidence. And I guess maybe if I saw like the domestic violence and everything else, it would just like, I mean, I think I would have to see his face. We did see his face a couple of times, but it's just.
So you're a member of the jury. You're in the jury pool. And they ask you after the third episode, do you think OJ did this?
Oh, man.
I know. And I know some of you are watching right now thinking, duh, he did it.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things like, okay, I'm going to use an example, law-abiding citizen with Gerard Butler.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's actually a bad example, but I'm just saying that how there are situations where it looks like that and people are kind of, they're innocent.
Yeah.
But
the Sam Shepard that F. Lee Bailey got off, the fugitive.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, So, I don't know.
And you also have to think it's 1994.
Yeah.
The state of just what was going on around that time.
Yeah.
From the episode here, knowing, because you changed the question. At first you said,
after these episodes,
would I think he did it versus if I was a member of the jury? Because the jury only knows so much.
I'm saying if you're a member of the jury after three episodes in the jury pool.
If I got to see all of that evidence as a member of the jury.
The three episodes.
Absolutely he's guilty because... Yeah. They've shown you behind the scenes that everybody believed he was guilty. They were all saying, we're screwed. Okay, let's come up with this thing and this strategy of blaming. And that's, they've said it openly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah.
Well, for me, I would think with like coming into this, just as a person,
mm-hmm.
I was leaning to the fact that OJ was probably guilty, just as, you know, as a person who's grown up with this news. But after these three episodes, this episode to me changed the game where I said, on the evidence, I don't think he's guilty so far, and so I'm trying to look at these three episodes with fresh eyes
because of the Mark Furman.
Oh
stuff.
Yeah, the Mark that he found all the key pieces of evidence and he said he's a big. To me, that was like okay, that's it. I mean, and so I don't know how it goes forward from here, but I thought that was the most damning piece of evidence.
I just feel bad because I can't. My whole thing is who else would do it?
Yeah,
and. The only other, and then in addition to that, is would he be capable of hiring someone to do it?
Yeah.
Possibly. Yeah. But then he's still guilty of murder.
Yeah, of course.
Right, but I'm just saying that that's where
when
it is.
When he asks about who did it, yeah.
Yeah.
See, the interesting thing for me is because I'm probably about 10 years older, if not more, than anybody on the panel. So when I look at it through my eyes, I look at it from a real clear remembrance of all these things going through. And so I had the same questions that you're having because you were probably, how old?
Yeah,
94, maybe 10, maybe something like that. I was probably 22, I think, at the time. And so I saw it all play out and I went through the thought process. Oh, my God. Oh, this Mark Furman guy. Oh, that could have happened. That could have happened. And so I have a slightly different vantage point probably than the millennials watching it that are discovering it for the first time, which I know is a concern of the families. And Fred Goldman, he said, you know, people are going to be seeing this for the first time. What are they going to think? What kind of light are they going to put this in? Because we put this, you know, a lot of people thought he was guilty. So I look at it and I can't take the reality of the rest of the evidence out of my consciousness and look at it through fresh eyes. But it's interesting to have the juxtaposition of different perspectives.
Yeah.
Well, good point. Good point. Guys, thanks so much. Let's get into
can we do a little
gossip.
Sorry, I got excited because I wanted to say something.
Do you have some news and gossip?
I have a couple of things.
Okay, let's
hear it. I have news. Well, not necessarily news. It's more like I have a homework assignment for everyone. Have entered, whether they've officially have said it's going to be about race, there is an article that I want everyone to read, including ourselves. I've already read it. Some of you may have also. It's called "I Don't Discuss Racism with White People" by John Mehta. An incredible article, but I want everyone to read it. For those of you I want everyone to read it just so that they can understand kind of both sides of the situation and why race would be an issue here. And then the second thing is that I do know Cuba Gooding Jr. and I remember him talking about the third and the fourth episode. I saw him after filming and how he said it was so emotionally draining. Mm-hmm. So my little gossip for you, but it's just so crazy because we're here now and I was waiting for this. I'm like, what happened? So to see it, I'm like, God, that's crazy. But I love to know that these actors how much they're involved, but how serious this case really is. Yeah. Because, you know, this is a grown ass man just tired and like, it's just nuts. Like what's going on and like what we have to learn and what I have to portray and what I have to do. So hopefully we can get more of that information if we can get some guests on.
We'd love to have more guests from the show and everything. And, or the family members, you know, I felt a little, not a little, I felt guilty this week as I was doing this and I was thinking, wow, here we are, we're doing this show, but there's real people that will never get their family members back.
Right.
Who are torn to pieces as the spectacle again is in the limelight. And, you know, in the episode, even Marsha Clark was so, you know, she was excited by what she was doing. And, I get the zeal that people would have from the opportunities that arise, the lawyers, all these people winning. And it just breaks my heart for the families because I really just thought, wow. They're going through it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're going through it again.
I have a little tidbit. So the Wendy Williams Show had on a guest, AJ Gibson. He's a well-known entertainment reporter. He's saying that Norman Bordeaux, he's the manager of OJ, says that OJ actually loves keeping up with news about himself. So he will watch TV. He'll kind of keep up on what's going on. But
can he phone in?
I wish.
Feel comfortable talking to him.
Yeah. But that his jail doesn't have FX, so he hasn't seen the show yet. Also, he mentioned, so the doctor that Will Smith played recently in the movie Concussion, Dr. Bennett Umalu, he said he would bet his medical license on the fact that OJ has CTE.
Mm. What is that?
Football player.
Never mind. I'm sorry.
Encephalopathy.
There you go. Thank you.
His brain was rattled in his head.
Yeah. So basically the symptoms are loss of memory, aggression.
Absolutely.
And it can't be diagnosed until the person has died. Yeah. So we don't know yet if he has it or not.
Suicidal thoughts.
Yeah.
So he said that he would bet his medical license on the fact that he has it, which is kind of...
Did you say it was hydroencephalitis?
No. CTE. Chronic traumatic.
Chronic traumatic.
Yeah. Encephaly.
Yeah, I did think that did cross my mind, but then I was like, I don't know, can I use that? But
I mean, he may have it. It's just one of those things that you can't diagnose now, and all you can do, at least with the NFL forward moving, is helping players stay healthy and remain healthy.
Right.
But yeah, nothing you can do about it for him now.
Right. But to that point, you know, like I've never understood the not guilty by reason of insanity, kind of on the same thing.
Yeah.
Shouldn't it be guilty and insane, or you know what I mean?
A lot of times you don't even have an understanding of what it is you're doing, you know.
Right.
So, you know, if I think I'm Batman killing Superman, I'm not. You know, that's more of an NGRI defense because I didn't even know I was killing this particular person.
But you should be. It's just so philosophically speaking, guilty and insane.
Oh, I mean, you still get put away for
someplace else.
Yeah, right? Exactly. You just don't
push yourself. Yeah.
Awesome guys.
No pun intended.
Where can the lovely people find you?
You can find me all on at Twitter at Stephanie Georgie and on Instagram at the Stephanie Georgie.
You can find me at Shaka Strong on Twitter and on Instagram and on Facebook.
and Chris Howard live on Twitter and legendarylivingdaily.com.
And you can find me on all social media at Pega Rad. We will see you next week. Thanks for watching.
Thanks for joining.
Bye. Ciao. Bye.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.